Okay, let's talk about water. I mean, it's so familiar, right? You see it every day. But just pause for a second and think about how it changes. You know, from solid ice you could literally walk on to, well, to invisible gas floating around us. It's this simple thing, water, but it's constantly shifting. It's gozing, really. So we're talking liquid water we drink, those fluffy clouds way up there, the huge ice sheets at the poles. How does it do all that? And like, why does it even matter? Well, today we're diving deep into exactly that. We'll look at water's three main states. What makes it change form? How does it help cool things down naturally? And yeah, how do clouds actually form? We'll trace the huge water cycle that keeps our planet going and touch on why saving water is, well, just so incredibly important. We're basically going to pull out the key ideas and some surprising bits from the chapter you sent over, give you a clear, sort of concise, but hopefully fascinating picture of water's journey. Okay, let's unpack this incredible journey of water and discover why it's truly a marvel.
It really is. And it's so easy to just take water for granted, isn't it? But its basic properties, they're literally what make life on Earth possible. We need it for everything. I mean, obviously, drinking, cooking, but it also carves out canyons, shapes our coastlines, drives the weather. And at room temperature, it's just this straightforward liquid. Tasteless, odorless, but it can dissolve so many things. That's why they call it the universal solvent, you know, and that dissolving power. It's crucial for biology, for geology, for pretty much everything happening on the planet.
And the story of how it got here. Wow. The chapter paints this amazing picture. Water's been around since Earth was like super young, maybe 4.8 billion years ago. Back then, the planet was incredibly hot, a total inferno. So water was mainly gas, just steam everywhere.
Right. Then things started to cool down, maybe around 3.8 billion years ago, a very, very slow cooling process. And as it cooled, that water vapor started condensing, turning back into liquid. Imagine rain, but lasting for thousands, maybe millions of
This
years.
is endless rain.
Pretty much forming the first oceans. And those oceans weren't just big pools of water, they were like the incubator, the place where early life got started.
That's incredible context.
Right?
But then there's this weird thing, right? This scarcity paradox you mentioned.
Yeah.
Earth looks blue from space, covered in water.
Exactly. It looks like a water world. But the actual numbers, they tell a very different story. About 97.5% of all the water on Earth, it's salt water in the oceans, which, yeah, cover about 70% of the surface. But that leaves only 2.5% as freshwater. Tiny amount.
Only 2.5%.
Yep. And most of that we can't easily get to. Like almost 69% is locked up solid in ice caps and glaciers. Another 30-something percent is groundwater deep down.
So what's left for us in lakes and rivers?
A minuscule amount, something like 0.3% of the total freshwater. That's it.
Wow. Okay, that really highlights why we need to be careful with it. It makes conservation seem, well, essential.
Absolutely critical. It's not just a statistic, it's the reality of our most precious resource.
So, okay, knowing it's this precious, unique substance,
Yeah.
what actually allows it to switch between solid, liquid, and gas so easily? It's got to be something fundamental, right?
It is. It all boils down to the molecules. The tiny H2O units water is made of, it's about how they're arranged, how much space is between them, and how strongly they stick together. We talk about intermolecular space, the gaps in intermolecular forces, especially the cohesive force, which is the attraction between water molecules themselves.
Gotcha. Molecules sticking together. So how does that play out in the different states? Let's start with solid.
Ice.
Okay, solid state, ice or frost. Here, the molecules are packed really tightly. They're arranged in a specific repeating pattern, a crystal structure. This gives ice its definite shape and a fixed volume. It happens, obviously, when things get cold enough, 0 degrees Celsius or 32 Fahrenheit.
Right. And you said something really interesting earlier about ice floating. Yes. That's the key thing about water ice. Unlike most substances, when water freezes, the molecules actually arrange themselves in a way that takes up more space. There's more intermolecular space in ice than in liquid water.
So it's less dense.
Exactly. Less dense. That's why it floats. And think about what that means for lakes in winter. The ice forms on top, acting like an insulator, protecting the liquid water and life
If
underneath.
it sank, disaster.
Total disaster. Lakes would freeze solid from the bottom up. Life couldn't survive. It's a really unique and vital property of water.
Okay, so that's solid. What about liquid, the state we see most often?
Right, liquid water. Here, the molecules have more energy. They're still attracted to each other, but not locked in place like in ice. They're more loosely packed. They can slide past one another. That's why water flows, why it takes the shape of whatever container you put it in. But the molecules are still close enough that it keeps a fixed volume.
Makes sense. Fluid, adaptable.
And then the gas state. water vapor, or steam. Now the molecules have gained a lot more energy, enough to completely break free from those attractive forces holding them together in liquid form. They're really far apart, moving around randomly very fast. So water vapor has no fixed shape or volume. It just spreads out to fill whatever space it's in. Like individual H2O molecules just zooming around.
And the really wild thing is, water is the only common stuff on Earth that we naturally find in all three states.
Yep.
Solid, liquid, gas, just within our normal range of temperatures.
That's right. That single fact is huge. It enables our entire climate system, the water cycle, everything.
Okay, and you mentioned clearing up some misconceptions, especially about the gas state.
Yeah, two common ones. First, when water boiled and turns to steam, the H2O molecules themselves don't break apart into hydrogen and oxygen.
No.
They stay as H2O. They just get enough energy to, like, escape the liquid phase and become a gas.
Right. The molecule itself is stable. Mm-hmm. It's just changing its energy level and how it interacts with its neighbors.
Precisely. And the second thing is about seeing steam.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about seeing steam from a kettle, right? That white cloud.
Yeah.
Well, true steam, pure water vapor, the gas is actually invisible. You can't see it.
So what is that white stuff then?
That white cloud is actually tiny, tiny droplets of liquid water. The hot, invisible water vapor hits the cooler air and instantly cools down and condenses back into microscopic liquid droplets.
Ah, so it's condensation happening right there in the air.
Exactly. It looks like steam, but it's technically a mist or fog of liquid water. A neat visual trick and a perfect example of condensation.
That is a great distinction. Okay, let's shift focus a bit to evaporation. This feels really important. It's happening all the time, isn't it?
Constantly. Evaporation is simply the process where liquid water changes into a gas water vapor. It usually happens right at the surface of the liquid. Basically, some molecules at the surface happen to gain enough energy, maybe from the sun or just ambient heat, to break free and escape into the air.
And this is key for the water cycle, right? And cooling things down.
Absolutely vital for both. It's how water gets from the ground and oceans up into the atmosphere. And yes, it has a significant cooling effect.
Okay, so what makes it happen fast or slow? You said there were factors.
Yep. Four main things influence the rate of evaporation. Think about drying your clothes outside.
Okay.
First, surface area. If you spread your wet towel out wide, it dries way faster than if it's bunched upright.
Definitely. More area exposed to the air.
Exactly. Larger surface area means more molecules are at the surface ready to escape. So faster evaporation. Second, temperature. Clothes dry much quicker on a hot, sunny day than a cool, cloudy one.
Makes sense. More heat means more energy for the molecules.
Right. Higher temperature, faster evaporation. Third factor, wind. A breezy day helps dry things faster, too.
Why is that?
Because the wind blows away the water vapor that's just escaped from the surface.
Yeah.
If the air right above the water gets saturated with vapor, evaporation slows down. Wind keeps that air moving, allowing more evaporation to happen.
Like clearing the way for more molecules to escape.
You got it. And fourth, humidity. This is about how much water vapor is already in the air.
Okay.
If the air is already really damp, really humid, like on a rainy day, it can't hold much more water vapor. So evaporation slows way down. That's why clothes take ages to dry when it's muggy.
Right. The air's already full. So surface area, temperature, wind, humidity. Got it.
And thinking about these factors leads to that cooling effect. This raises an important question. How does something seemingly simple like evaporation have such profound impacts, from keeping our drinks cool to influencing global weather patterns? Well, when those water molecules escape the liquid surface during evaporation, they take energy specifically, heat energy, with them from their surroundings.
So the stuff left behind loses heat.
Precisely. The liquid left behind, or the surface it evaporated from, gets cooler. It's a natural cooling mechanism.
And we actually use this. You mentioned the matka, the clay pot. How does that work again?
Yeah, the traditional Indian clay pot, the matka. It's porous, so a tiny bit of water seeps through the clay to the outer surface. Then that water on the outside evaporates. As it evaporates, it draws heat from the pot and the water inside.
Cooling the water inside. That's so clever. Simple physics.
It is. A brilliant low-tech refrigerator. Or think about hand sanitizers, the alcohol-based ones.
Oh, yeah. They feel really cold when you put them on.
Exactly. The alcohol evaporates very, very quickly off your skin. That rapid evaporation pulls heat away from your hand, making it feel instantly cool.
So understanding this stuff isn't just, like, academic. It explains things we experience every day and helps us know, like, the best way to dry laundry.
Definitely practical.
Okay, so we have these individual processes, freezing, melting, evaporating, condensing. How do they all fit together in the big picture?
They all connect through Earth's massive, continuous plumbing system, the water cycle. It's this grand journey water takes, moving between the atmosphere, the land, the oceans, living things, everywhere. And the driving force behind all these changes, these transitions between solid, liquid, and gas, it's energy, heat energy being absorbed or released.
Let's trace that cycle again, just to be clear. Where does it sort of start?
Well, it's a cycle, so it doesn't really have a start or end, but a good place to begin is with evaporation. The sun's heat provides the energy. It warms up water in oceans, lakes, rivers, puddles, turning it into invisible water vapor that rises up into the atmosphere.
Okay, sun evaporates water. But you mentioned plants, too.
Yes. Don't forget transpiration. Plants absorb water through their roots, and then they release water vapor back into the air through tiny pores in their leaves.
Like they're breathing out water.
Kind of, yeah. And it's a lot of water. A single big tree can transpire hundreds of liters or gallons of water vapor in a single day. It adds a huge amount of moisture to the air.
Wow. Okay, so evaporation and transpiration get water vapor into the air. What happens next?
That warm, moist air rises. As it gets higher, the atmosphere gets colder. This cooling causes the water vapor to undergo condensation. The molecules slow down, lose energy, and clump together again, forming tiny liquid water droplets or, if it's cold enough, ice crystals. These clumps are what make up clouds.
So clouds are just masses of tiny water droplets or ice crystals.
Essentially, yes. We also see condensation closer to the ground, like dew forming on grass overnight or water droplets on the outside of a cold drink on a humid day. Same process.
Right. So clouds form, then what?
Inside the clouds, those tiny droplets or crystals bump into each other and combine, getting bigger and heavier. Eventually, they get so heavy that gravity pulls them down, and that's precipitation. Rain, snow, sleet, hail, depending on the temperature conditions.
Water returning to Earth. And then?
Then the water lands. Some of it flows over the surface as runoff, collecting in streams, rivers, and eventually making its way back to lakes or oceans. Some seeps into the ground, becoming groundwater. Some might fall as snow and get locked up in glaciers for a while. But eventually, it all keeps moving, ready to evaporate or transpire again, completing the cycle. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, the water cycle isn't just some diagram in a textbook. It's, like you said, the lifeblood of our planet. It's constantly moving this absolutely essential resource around. It balances water levels, shapes our weather, creates habitats, carries nutrients. Life as we know it depends entirely on this continuous cycle. It even helps regulate Earth's temperature by moving heat around.
But linking back to that scarcity thing,
mm-hmm.
This amazing cycle distributes water. But the amount of easily usable fresh water is still tiny.
Exactly. And with more people on the planet needing more water for drinking, farming, industry, the demand on that tiny fraction is increasing all the time.
Which brings us back to conservation.
Absolutely. It's not just a nice thing to do. It's becoming increasingly necessary. And it doesn't always mean huge changes. Simple things like fixing leaky taps. You'd be amazed how much water a dripping faucet wastes over time. Or choosing water-efficient washing machines and toilets, maybe collecting rainwater for gardens.
The small actions adding up.
They really can. It's about being mindful of how precious this resource is, given how little of it is readily available.
Okay, so let's just quickly recap then. We've journeyed through water's three amazing states. Solid ice, flowing liquid, invisible gas. We saw how the way its molecules arrange themselves is key. We looked at evaporation, how it gets water into the air and cools things down, influenced by stuff like temperature and wind. And we traced the whole grand water cycle, evaporation, transpiration, condensation, precipitation, runoff, this nonstop movement that sustains everything. Water's ability to constantly change form is, well, it's everything.
It really underpins so much of how our planet works.
So next time you see a cloud drifting by, or watch a puddle disappear after the rain, or even just see an ice cube floating in your drink, maybe pause for a second. You'll know there's this incredible dynamic science happening right there. It's pretty amazing stuff. Which leads to a final thought, maybe something to chew on. Considering how vital water is and how it's always changing, always moving, how might really understanding these fundamental processes help us? How can that deeper understanding equip us to be smarter, more innovative, maybe more sustainable in managing this absolutely vital resource, especially as our world keeps changing?